Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we learn about the ongoing efforts to restore artworks that were confiscated or sold under duress during the Nazi era to their rightful owners and heirs. Mark Mazurofsky is the co-founder of the Holocaust Art Restitution Project, and he has served as its director of research. He's researched the questions of such assets that were looted during the Holocaust and World War II for over 30 years. And he's worked as an expert historian on a class action lawsuit for Jewish claimants seeking restitutions of lost accounts and other liquid assets from Swiss banks. As a consultant historian for the Department of Justice's Office of Special Investigations, he researched alleged Nazi war criminals living in the U.S., interviewed witnesses to crimes against humanity, and studied post-war relations between former Nazi officials and allied intelligence agencies. He'll be a guest at the annual Sherwin Miller Museum Gala this Sunday, and you can get information on attending that gala at 918-492-1818. Or visit jewishmuseum.net. Mark Mazurofsky joins us today by phone here on Studio Tulsa. Mark Mazurofsky, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me.
Given the number of high-profile art restitution resolutions, you've had a number of paintings by Gustav Klimt, Egon Schiele, and several other artists. It seems like if you're watching this, there seems to be one in the news every few months, that this issue of art ownership during the Nazi years, the plunder and the selling under duress, is resolving itself. Is that the case, or are these cases exceptions to the overall rule?
Well, I like to say it'd be the former, but unfortunately it's the latter. It is the exception to the rule, because when you look at the overall number of works and objects that have been looted, the numbers are staggering, and the other reason why you might feel that there is an increase in resolution of these issues is because the focus is on very high-priced items, which obviously serves as a great motivator for both the legal profession and the auction market. It's a combination of all sorts of factors that make it possible to essentially facilitate some of these restitutions. Now, granted, you know, the profit motive should not be associated with it. It's just simply that in the end, these works do fetch a phenomenal amount of money, as you saw with Klimt. Mm-hmm. And I think in general, there is a sense that if you focus on the majority of the objects that were stolen, which are not a very high value, I mean, by today's standards, I mean, even though you and I could probably not purchase them, unless you have some kind of slush fund somewhere, they don't interest the community of lawyers who are quote-unquote specialists in art restitution matters. And I'm not saying this to be disparaging. It's simply because there is a cost-benefit analysis that is regularly applied to the question of restitution. And when you are trying your best to recover work which costs $50,000, you know how lawyers bill, and you know what the, especially when you have to go through the civil courts, it is a very, very time-consuming and obviously labor-intensive and therefore expensive matter, which ends up obliterating the actual value of the piece. So there are people who have said very clearly they will not go after anything which is under $1 million in value. I can understand them, but at the same time, it doesn't do anything for the 95% of claimants out there who've lost their cultural property, which, as it turns out, is of sufficient cultural value to be exhibited in galleries and even sometimes in museums. So there is a double standard, and unfortunately, it's kind of Darwinian as far as justice is concerned. I wish it would be different.
You referred to it as cultural property, and this is probably a misnomer. Most people who see this field from afar, that we think of it as strictly artworks, but it is cultural objects. It's everything from family menorahs to, you know, to silver to all sorts of items. Give us a sense of how large that body of objects that could be restituted. What is the number as far as what's out there? Do we have a sense of how many pieces?
Well, let's do some basic math. By the end of the Second World War, which ended in May 1945, and on the Japanese side, it ended in August 1945 with what you all remember as being the A-bombs that fell on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we can surmise the following. There are between 50 and 60 million people who perished during the conflict, 6 million of whom were of Jewish descent. Another 5 million basically perished in other concentration camps, prisons, etc. And if you even conservatively estimate, strictly speaking, Jewish property, we can at least talk about 1 to 5 million pieces. And in general, there are 19 countries that were either occupied, controlled, or annexed by the National Socialist Government and its fascist allies over a 12-year period. So we can rightfully assume that each one of those countries suffered losses in the hundreds of thousands of objects. So we're getting close to 15 million objects of all categories, all values combined. We're talking about not just paintings or works on paper, like drawings, etchings, prints, lithographs, etc. We're also talking about furniture. We're talking about musical instruments. We're talking about rare books, incunabulized manuscripts. We're talking about accessories, decorative objects, like netsukis, like African masks, Bosnian spears, or all sorts of items that have been given a large definition of cultural objects, and the sky's the limit. Roman glass, Egyptian antiquities were stolen also. So everything went, as long as it was culturally significant and relevant to the Nazis. Where did they go? I mean, for instance, ethnological museums, anthropological museums, archaeological museums greeted and welcomed with open arms some of these objects. Decorative arts museums greeted these objects with open arms. And also the international art market was more than willing to recycle these objects. No questions asked, even though many of these auctioneers fully understood that the sudden rush and upsurge in goods coming through their rooms for sale clearly could have come only from one source. But, you know, if you don't ask questions, then obviously it's not going to hurt you. So we're talking about a very complicated but fairly amoral world that is unfolding as a result of genocide, mass slaughter, etc., all those really wonderful things that characterize the Second World War, the Nazi era, and the Holocaust. Post-war has been essentially contaminated by all these objects. I mean, I use sort of a biological word, but it is a form of contamination, at least in a metaphorical sense, because you should always, always wonder when you walk into bric-a-bracs, antique stores, go to auction houses, go to galleries, museums, where do these objects come from?
And of course,
unfortunately, unless they're purely American, native, you know, or primitive in the early 19th century, and God knows what those stories are like, chances are there's a story behind them.
Will you bring this point into it? I mean, certainly the plunder from the Nazi era should still be recovered, but at some point as history moves on, do we go back to the 19th and 18th century in America where objects from, say, you know, indigenous people are in museums? You mentioned Egyptian antiquities. Were those sold in a rightful manner from Egypt when they ended up in Europe in the first place, or were they plundered? Is there or should there be a statute of limitations on how far we go back, given the whole history of the spoils of war? And I'm not putting this on Nazi-era restitutions. I think that's a separate issue. But how far should we go back, in your view, as a historian?
Well, I like to think that obviously we can't make up for anything relating to colonial wars. I mean, that's really going back to the Big Bang, so to speak. I think there's some notable exceptions, especially with Native Americans. We did engage in, the U.S. government did sign treaties and broke them and repeatedly plundered tribes that made up most of the 500 nations of North America. So there are some legal liabilities, and it's not that's why it's a separate discussion.
Mm-hmm.
But I think your point is correct. There's a confluence of factors right now which is prompting certain European countries and even some countries in Asia to proclaim the right to recover items that are in Western collections. And there, I think it's complicated. I think it's a mixture of cultural nationalism. There's some definite domestic political factors that are playing in this type of request. You can see this in Egypt. You can see this in Turkey right now. Egypt is more complicated, obviously, because it's been a long-standing trade, mostly illegal, of purloined items from plenty of archaeological sites. But the French, for instance, have reclaimed a painting last year, which had been taken out of France in 1818. That, I think, is a bit egregious. And all of a sudden, you know, they pulled out an inventory. So saying that it was on their list. But it's funny because they don't seem to have a similar list for Second World War items. So you sort of, this is what we're talking about. We're talking about a lot of hypocrisy here. And so to answer your question about where do we start the clock, I would say we started with the late 1890s, early 20th century, when there were a series of conventions at The Hague in the Netherlands, which brought together statesmen, diplomats, civil servants from all over the world to essentially discuss the rules of warfare. And these conventions are, in fact, the starting point for most issues pertaining to international law today, especially in terms of warfare, protection of civilian populations, and by extension, the safety and safeguarding of cultural property. So that's where I would start it. So 1898, 1907 should be sort of legal sort of milestone. Now, of course, somebody's going to scream and say, well, what about the Elgin marbles that are in the British Museum? I'd say, well, okay, well, maybe that's an exception because this is a longstanding case. That's not about to get resolved. The arguments used there are typical arguments used by fairly well-off, well-endowed museums in the West, sort of posing as heralds of Western culture, which is, in and of itself, fairly obnoxious. I mean, it's kind of an arrogant posture to take in the first place. Telling an entire nation that it cannot take care of its own cultural property is somewhat patronizing and condescending. I understand that, you know, museums in Greece might not be as well equipped as museums in London and New York to care and protect, but, you know, there are thefts everywhere. So we just saw that in Holland several days ago.
Yes, that's true.
So these are, you know, these issues have to be resolved very differently, but it also requires a significant change in mindset and attitude. And one has to go from, well, we are heralds of Western culture to, well, who owns culture? In other words, who has the right to say, I am the owner of an item, even if it doesn't legally belong to me, but because of all sorts of circumstances, it is better off staying with me. And that's a very twisted argument. And the problem is compounded by the fact that, for instance, in the United States, there is no explicit cultural policy. I mean, the U.S. government has always deferred to the marketplace. In other words, it waits for things to happen in the courts in order to make decisions, and so it's essentially very reactive. We saw this even with Japanese Americans who were interned in California and the Western states. Many of their assets were stolen. I mean, basically, it was outright theft, seizures, very much like what was going on in Europe during the 1930s. There were laws passed after the war, which thought to try to remedy, but of course nothing ever happened. I did find, for instance, a painting that was taken from a Japanese-American artist, which was hanging at the National Portrait Gallery in Washington, D.C., and the label actually said confiscated in 1942. And that painting since then has been bouncing around from one federal repository to another. So, you know, it is complicated, and this is a question of both trivializing and at the same time warping the sense of who owns cultural items, cultures of other people. And we have to come to some kind of understanding, otherwise this is going to go on forever. And there's some recent debates about instituting the so-called global museum. Well, it's a beautiful idea, except the global museum idea, which is basically marrying partnership museums and cultural institutions from developing countries, emerging countries, with institutions from the West. But one of the key conditions is to let bygones be bygones and to forget what happened in the past. You can't erase history, so it's a great approach, but it requires you to essentially forgive the sins of the past. Are you willing to do that? Am I willing to do that? I know that I'm not, because that's too easy. We're all accountable, and we should be accountable for massive, massive thefts and displacements of cultural assets, which have been displayed for the enjoyment of the entire American and public of other countries. But is that fair? Is that equitable? And that's a question that we should all ask ourselves.
My guest today is Mark Mazurowski, a historian and co-founder of the Holocaust Art Restitution Project. He'll be the guest of honor at the Sherwin Miller Museum of Jewish Art's annual gala on October 28th, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa, joining us by phone. I want to ask you about this. There's some legislation in Congress now. It's sponsored by the American Association of Art Museum Directors, which would basically, I think they've carved out an exception for Nazi-era plunder or selling under duress, but for basically any other era where somebody has a claim of restitution, it would, if a piece of art or an object comes into the United States from a collection somewhere outside of the U.S., they have immunity from any proceedings. And I know that your organizations that you're affiliated with really view this as very, very troubling. And I guess this comes out of the Egon Schiele's Portrait of Wally, which was seized when it was on exhibition, actually lawfully seized when it was on exhibition here in the United States.
I'm glad you brought this up, actually. In its current incarnation, it's referred to as Senate Bill 2212. It's currently sitting in the Senate Judiciary Committee. The co-sponsors are Senators Dianne Feinstein for Democrats and Senator Orrin Hatch for the Republicans. And it's true, it's the AAMD, the American Association of Museum Directors, that drafted the bill. It's actually Machiavellian. I have to hand it to them. By introducing that legislation, they would clear the decks completely of any possibility for any country or individual to file a claim for items that would enter the United States for display in an American institution. I mean, it's brilliant. It really is. It's. I have to hand it to them. They really, really sort of thought this out and figured they would go for the common denominator. Now, yes, the problem is this Nazi exception, as it's being called. The problem is, again, this quote-unquote exception or clarification, depending on who you're talking to. It's actually a misnomer because the category of objects that this exception or clarification would cover, and basically any object falling into those categories would be subject to claims. It's a very small category. In fact, very coincidentally, it does not cover a huge category of objects that have been the subject of litigation in the United States, and namely objects that were illegally sold under duress in Germany in the 1930s, and in fact, most of the cases in the U.S., with the exception of the Schiele and Klimt cases, were cases of forced sales. And there was actually a very clear judgment in Rhode Island a number of years ago. It's called the Bissonnette case, where a painting belonging to a dealer from Düsseldorf, Germany, Max Stern, had been illegally sold. He was forced to liquidate his collection. He sold mostly old masters to German industrialists, and he was forced to emigrate to Canada. Well, the judge in that case ruled very clearly that a forced sale is theft. And, of course, that would not make American museum directors too happy to hear that because it is jurisprudential and it paved the way for subsequent cases to be tried. So I think it's less Schiele and Klimt. It's also Bissonnette. And these types of cases are absolutely nefarious for museums because that means that they have to contend now with a whole new approach to provenance, in other words, to ownership history research for objects in their collections. And that takes time, of course, because they never did it. And or if they did it, they did it very partially. And even if they found out that it was a problem, then they decided, you know, to forget about the problem and to deal with it later, because God knows where the claimant is, if there is a claimant, et cetera, et cetera. So the legislation itself is actually obnoxious for the following reasons. Why would you forgive one act of plunder and condone all others? In other words, make the Jewish community complicit to enabling objects looted from other cultures and other countries to enter the United States safely. So it's actually it's very twisted and perverse logic. So we've asked the Senate Judiciary Committee at least to hold open hearings so that all sides can be heard. And the AAMD does not want an open hearing because I think it realizes that it will not prevail, because it's quite clear that not just the Jewish community, at least some parts of it, but also archaeologists, foreign countries, even other American museums, because that is a dirty little secret. There are a fair number of smaller American museums that do not want to be caught up in this dragnet of showing illicitly obtained property, because, surprise, surprise, there are ethical museum directors and curators out there, but they do not exert the same amount of influence that the Art Institute of Chicago, the Metropolitan Museum, the Museum of Modern Art, the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston exert in terms of shaping the cultural landscape of this country. They don't have the political clout to do it, but somebody should listen to them and should talk to them and find out from them how they feel about exhibiting objects that could be subject to restitution. I don't think they really want to do that.
Yeah.
And in fact, when you see the restitution rates, they're higher in smaller museums than they are in large museums.
Interesting.
I think that's a significant point to make, because they are teaching museums, they are museums that are devoted to their communities, and they use, actually, restitutions as a vehicle to educate their publics and to raise awareness and to say, listen, you have to be ethical custodians and guardians of culture, and especially of objects that enter your collections. And it's especially significant for state-owned museums, for museums that are affiliated with state universities, that have an additional burden because they are funded and subsidized by your esteemed tax dollars. And therefore, you do not want to know that your tax dollars are being used to sponsor, to enable, and to acquire stolen property.
Let me ask you about the whole idea of provenance. You know, provenance can be faked and forged, but would you say most museums do a good job of actually documenting provenance, or let's turn a blind eye, let's accept what's there at face value? What exactly?
I think I'll answer your question this way. More efforts have been made recently, especially in light of all these cases and all this emerging awareness that actually history does tend to insinuate itself in the path of ownership of an object. It would appear to be completely logical, but until recently, it seemed to be completely irrelevant in the minds of museum directors, curators, art historians, auctioneers, gallery owners, and collectors who just simply didn't think that an object could actually have a history. Mm. So we call that decontextualizing the object. It's almost like the object is a direct beneficiary of spontaneous birth. You know, it just comes out of the clouds, has no past, no present, no future. And that's been really the way that art has been treated for a very long time, and to a certain extent it continues to be. With that in mind, yes, provenance work is highly defective in most institutions. There are some now that are doing a much better job than they used to, but I have to say that they're a minority. The other problem is that provenance research is tedious, and it's laborious. So it does put the onus on your shoulders to ask the person who is donating or selling the item or loaning it to you to ask the relevant questions. It's not that you want to be obnoxious. It's because you want to protect yourself. It's also because you really want to understand the history of the object. I understand if the object is 500 years old, you're not going to be able to flesh out every minute of the day where that object was, but you certainly could find out where the object was at a particular time, especially if there was a war, especially if there was a civil conflict, and particularly if there was a genocidal enterprise, you know, evolving where the object was located. So you need to understand these things. And even in the most banal way, families steal objects from one another. There are callous dealers out there who basically swindle their collectors. There are lawyers, notaries, and other individuals who will do some funny things. We don't know. But these are the kinds of due diligence questions that have to be asked. And I know it's tedious because you don't want to tick off your donor, especially if the donor is a very important person in your community. And I understand the social pressures that this exerts on this small institution. But at some point, somebody has to stand up and say, listen, we run an ethical place here, and I understand that you're so-and-so, you own this factory, you know the president of the university, et cetera, but we have to do our job here. And your impressionist paintings are wonderful, but we have to make sure that they're not tainted. Of course, that doesn't go well, but that's not a conversation that's very easy to have, but it's a conversation that needs to take place more and more often.
Let me ask you very quickly in our last couple of minutes.
Yeah.
You mentioned a number of institutions which I assume are not very good at dealing with these issues of provenance and restitution and the idea of these artworks perhaps being plundered at some point or sold under duress. What institutions are doing a good job in your mind? Are there some that are?
Yes, actually, I like to name at least the ones that I know of.
Okay.
The museum at the Indiana University of Bloomington, Indiana, when faced with a claim from a small Berlin museum, didn't hesitate and returned the object. And not only that, it organized a whole series of seminars and workshops about the Second World War, restitution, plunder, etc. So they get an A for effort. The Kimball Art Museum in Texas actually did the right thing. When faced with a claim for a Turner painting, it didn't hire lawyers. It didn't hide behind their board of trustees. In fact, they just simply had a series of discussions that were facilitated by the Christie's auction house, and the painting was returned. So that's another example. The Mary Brogan Museum in Tallahassee, Florida, when faced with a claim last year for a painting by an Italian master, Romanino, which had been lent by an Italian museum, turns out that it belonged to an Italian Jewish family and that had lost its paintings in a forced sale in Paris in 1941 when it was under German occupation. There, the Italian government had forgotten to immunize the painting, so it made it possible for the U.S. attorney to come in and to seize it. The museum was more than happy to basically not fight it, and basically that painting went back to the owner. So there's, you know, there are a number of cases which are unfolding. There's some dealers in New York, like Richard Feigen, who was very, very cooperative with the Max Stern Foundation, which is based in Canada, when it came time to return some old masters. So, yes, I mean, there are people out there who do the right thing. There are just not enough of them. But on the other hand, I have to name the Museum Modern Art, the Guggenheim, and others for having been ridiculously obstreperous and for basically showing themselves to be completely antithetical and against the whole concept of restitution. And what they do is that they basically use this really worn-out phrase of fair and just solution in terms of making sure that these items stay in their collections. Fair and just simply means how much do you want, you the claimant, to go away and not bother us anymore about this restitution request. So they acknowledge that there's a problem with the work, but they insist that they are the current possessors.
Interesting.
So you have this taking place more and more, and it's a, you know, it's a very unfortunate way of looking at the law and looking at ethics. So I have to hand it over to the museum to don't hide behind these types of legal maneuvers, and I have to basically tell the MoMAs of the world that the examples are set, and when you decide not to restitute, well, because you decide not to restitute, it is an act of will. And as you well know, as well as I do, where there's a will, there's a way. So this is a voluntary act. It's a decision that you make to do the right thing, quote unquote. It is not something that you are prevented from doing. It is something that you can do if you want to do it.
All
so
right.
The Museum of Fine Arts in Boston actually should be congratulated also for having found a solution with a Holocaust survivor. I have to say that the evidence was really, really flimsy in the sense that, you know, it wouldn't have stood up in court, but for the first time in its history, they had actually decided to do, quote-unquote, the right thing and find a solution with this man who basically had gone to Auschwitz after being persecuted in Germany. So for an institution like the MFA to do that, I think it sets a standard that, in fact, it is possible to reach some kind of understanding. That is a discussion, you see. It is not a pressure point. It is not an intimidation telling the claimant, well, you don't have a claim, but let's see what we can do about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's another kind of conversation.
Well, that's interesting. You'll hear more at the Sherwin Miller Museum of Jewish Arts Annual Gala when Mark Mazurofsky will be the guest. Mark, thanks very much for your time today.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. It was a pleasure.
Mark Mazurofsky is the co-founder of the Holocaust Art Restitution Project. He'll be a guest of the annual Sherwin Miller Museum Gala, Thoroughly Modern Miller, this Sunday here in Tulsa. Information on attending at 918-492-1818 or jewishmuseum.net. There are plenty of other activities this weekend as well. Earlier this week, we spoke with Alfonso Martin, the principal dancer at Tulsa Ballet, about their production of Dracula this weekend. And we hope to speak with one of the writers to be featured at Nimrod's annual conference for readers and writers on Saturday here at TU. But unfortunately, that didn't happen. We want to remind you that the conference is taking place tomorrow on the TU campus and will feature U.S. Poet Laureate Philip Levine, fiction writer Gish Jin, children's book author Mira Bartok, whose memoir won the National Book Critics Circle Award, and over 20 other writers and editors talking about the craft of writing. Information on the conference at 918-631-3080. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.